Good morning, everybody. How are we doing? Everybody doing good? All right. Well, like Joel said, welcome to week two of questions. And the point of this series was that we had requested from the church that you send us any and all questions that you might have about God, about faith, about Christianity, about the church. And we would do our best to answer those questions. And so we got 50, 60 questions from the church. And so now we're trying to figure out how to answer all those questions. And so one of the things that we've been doing is we've been looking for themes or commonality in the questions. Is there something specific that lots of people are wondering about? And try to tackle those topics first. And so last week, we talked a lot about the existence of God. A lot of people send in questions wondering, how do we know that God exists? How do we know that our faith is a reasonable faith? And so we went into an introduction into what it looks like to think that way last week, and hopefully that was helpful. This week, we're going to tackle another type of question that we saw lots of people asking, and lots of people were curious about this, and the question looked like this. What does the Bible say about, and you fill in the blank, all right? What does the Bible say about a social issue? What does the Bible say about a cultural issue? What does the Bible say about this specific doctrine or belief? What does the Bible say about this thing that this church doesn't seem to emphasize, but the church that I came from thought was really important? What does the Bible say about those things? And the most prevalent topic specifically that came from this question was about heaven and hell. What does the Bible say about heaven and hell? So later, we're going to bring Joel up, and we're going to have a conversation where we talk about what we believe the Bible says about that specific topic. But I actually think that it's worth addressing this question in general, because we take something for granted that's assumed in this question that I think is absolutely extraordinary. What we implicitly bring to the table by even asking this is something that I think is almost unfathomable, almost unbelievable. By asking this question, what does the Bible say about anything, we are assuming that this book is telling us something. Think about how crazy that is. We think that this book is actually telling us something. This thing we call the Bible is speaking to us. And by asking what it says about certain things that we think are important, it's not just speaking to us, but what it's speaking to us matters. See, as Christians, we believe and we confess that this book that we call the Bible is the Word of God. And so it's not just any act of communication. Within these pages, within these stories, within this book, God is actually speaking to us. God is communicating to us. This book is a divine act of communication. And so it's really important, right? Those questions are really good, because if that's true, if God's speaking to us through this book, it's important that we understand what he's saying, that we understand how to approach what he's saying so that we can discern proper meaning from the way that he speaks to us. And so I want to talk about that today. If this book is an act of communication, you think of the way that we tend to communicate with each other. What's one of the foundational elements of the way that we interact with each other, that we produce meaning, and that we receive meaning? It's language. Language is a building block, one of the foundations of how we communicate. We use lots of nonverbal body language. We speak and we hear language. We write and we read language. We sing and we worship and we praise in language. Language is really important for communication. And if you ever wonder about that, or you think maybe that's not true, all that you have to do is go to a foreign country and spend a little bit of time in a place where they don't speak your language primarily, and you'll start to feel this thing in the pit of your stomach. And what it is anxiety and discomfort, because you don't speak that language. And so all of a sudden, you're in this place where seemingly easy tasks like ordering coffee, ordering food, become difficult. You're not sure if you're going to be able to communicate that. And on top of that, you feel like if something bad were to happen, like what if an emergency happens and I have to communicate with someone, I might not be able to do that because of language. They might not be able to communicate with me because of language. And so we feel this anxiety because the language that people speak is so essential to the meaning that comes from these communication acts. Before I came to 514 Church, I worked at Abercrombie & Fitch's home office right down the road. And I was in the department that's called International Real Estate. And so what we did was we went around the country and we went to these different markets and we were in charge of crafting a strategy and opening up new stores in new markets. So I spent a lot of time in places where I did not speak the language primarily. So I know that feeling very well, that feeling of anxiety. And there's lots of, you know, looking back on it, funny things that happen when you don't speak the language. One of the places that we were most concentrated on was China, right? It's this big country. There's all kinds of opportunity for expansion. And so we wanted to open stores in China. And so I was in the home office, and I was traveling over to China very often, back and forth. And we actually had two people over in China who were stationed there, right? Their home office was in Shanghai. And one of them is one of my good friends to this day. His name is Domenico Casile. All right, so you can tell he's Italian, he's from Milan, and he has lived in China now for like 10, 12, 13 years. He's been there for a long time. He's like an expert in the industry. He's an expert in that market because he's lived there for so long. And I owe so much of my positive experience at Abercrombie to Domenico because, you know, he had every right to just tell me I didn't know what I was doing because I didn't compared to him. But instead, he allowed me to have a voice. He empowered me. Every time he comes into town, to this day, we hang out and we talk with each other. And he means a lot to me as a person. And one of the things that I love the most about him is that he's quirky. He's very quirky. He's very funny. You walk around with him, he just makes you laugh at the little things that he does. He's like super dramatic. So you would tell him like seemingly mundane facts or information, and he would be like, "What? No. John, John, I. And you're like, "That seems inappropriate for what I just said. That was very factual." And so he just make you laugh. When you talk to him on the phone, you'd be like, "Okay, Domenico, it's good to talk to you. I'll talk to you tomorrow." And every single time before you'd hang up, he would be like, "Okay, bye-bye, John. Bye-bye, bye, John. Bye, John, bye, John." Until you would hang the phone up. I talked to him twice a day, every day. And he would do, and I never asked him why. It was just this quirk that was funny about him. He'd make you laugh. And so I got to travel around with him. I got up close and personal with all of these quirks. And it was really funny. He's a really funny guy to be around. One of the things that was most quirky about him is that, like I said, he had lived in China for 12 years. He was an expert in the Chinese real estate market. He was married to a woman who was born and raised in China, but he did not speak Chinese. He didn't speak the language, which is kind of interesting. Now, don't get me wrong. He had been around the language long enough that he knew certain phrases. He was familiar with words, and he could hear things and kind of understand what was going on. But conceptually speaking, he did not speak Chinese. He did not speak the language. And I did not speak any Chinese. And so we traveled China together. And every once in a while, some funny things came up from this inability to communicate. And overall, he was very successful at getting around, but when the complexity of the conversation reached a certain point, it became difficult for him to be able to interact. And so there was one time that we were in a train station in a city called Hangzhou, and it's about a half an hour train ride from Shanghai, and our meeting had went long, and so we missed the train back to Shanghai. They come about every 2 hours, and the next train was booked. And you do not want to spend 4 hours in the Hangzhou train station. So he was negotiating with the ticket office, and it wasn't going very well, as you can imagine. And so it's going back and forth. I'm like, I don't know what you guys are saying, but it's not working. Eventually he gets frustrated, and you can tell he's frustrated because he starts speaking Italian, which was the language, since he spoke such good English, he only spoke Italian around me when he was cursing and swearing. And so he was speaking Italian now, and I was like, oh boy. And he puts his tickets down on the counter, and he slides them across, and he puts his hands on his hips, and he looks at the lady behind the counter. And I was like, what is happening right now? And she starts speaking in Chinese. And she starts speaking and speaking and speaking and talking and talking for like 5 minutes. And this is ironic for me to say this right now, but have you ever heard someone speak for 5 straight minutes without stopping them? I mean, that's a long time to listen to somebody talk, especially in a conversational context. And so she's just going on and on and on. She's speaking and speaking and speaking on and on and on. And I'm looking back and forth, and I'm like, what is happening right now? I don't know what this is. And finally, she stops after 5 straight minutes of speaking in Chinese, and she looks at him. And I kid you not, he looks at me, he looks back at her, and he goes, huh? And I was like, came undone. I mean, I start lecturing him in the middle of the Hangzhou train station. I'm like, you have to stop her after 15 seconds. I mean, there's no reason to let her talk for that long. Why, you just tell her you don't speak the language. You know, I'm like freaking out. It was not a great moment for me. But looking back on it, that's very funny. That's like a funny thing to witness, somebody do that. And if I could define Domenico's ability to communicate in that culture, what I would say was that he knows some of the words. He knows some of the phrases, but he doesn't speak the language. And so today, when people are asking us about what does the Bible say about certain things, there's this thing that I think is true about me and that I think is true about us, that this act of communication, if we're honest with ourselves, most of us who've been around the church, we have this communication, and I think that a lot of us speak some words. We know some of these words. We know some of these phrases, but we don't quite know how to speak the language yet. We don't quite know how to approach the Bible from a holistic perspective. And that's not our fault. Like, I want you to understand me. This is not something that I think you are deficient in. Think about from the time you were very young to now, how has the Bible always been presented to you? How has it almost always been presented to you? In pieces and parts. Verses here and verses there, right? Here's a verse for this situation. Here's a verse for this situation. I wonder what I'm supposed to think about this issue. Okay, here's a verse for that. And we think about it like that. Right? A lot of us, that's the way that we've been exposed to it. We know verses in Romans, we know verses in Philippians, we know verses in 1 Samuel, but we don't know how they connect or if they connect at all. And so if we extend the metaphor of language one step further, I think that a lot of us walk around, and what we've been taught is that we have a phrase book Bible, a phrase book, right? Now, if you think about what a phrase book is, if you're going to go to Italy, you might buy a phrase book. And a phrase book has specific sayings, specific phrases that you can say for specific moments, right? So you need to ask how to go to the bathroom. You can open up your phrase book and see how do I go to the bathroom and say it in Italian. You know how to order food. Maybe you open it up and it'll say, may I please have, and then you got to say the word. It's a phrase book. It's a piece and it's a part. And it works for that specific setting. But it doesn't mean that we speak the language, right? And so let me be very clear about this. When you use a phrase book to speak Italian, you are actually speaking the language. It's not fake, it's not wrong, it's not incorrect, it's not bad. You're actually speaking the language. There's just a limit to the complexity and the depth that you're able to interact using only a phrase book. And I think the same thing is true of the Bible. The verses that we know, the verses that have become close to our hearts, those are real. That's God speaking. That's you understanding who God is and who you are from that word. But there is limits to the way in which we can use that approach to the Bible, the depth that we can go, how deep can this really mean in my life, and how does this inform the whole picture? Let me show you what I mean. There are certain verses that this works really well for, right? Romans 8:28. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. I believe that's true. I believe this is a good picture of God. This informs us. This is real. We're speaking the language. That's real, right? Philippians 4:13, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. That's real. That's God. That's us speaking the language. God speaking to us. You know, we're actually speaking the language, and it's real, and it's right, and it's good, right? There's so many of these. Everybody knows this verse, 1 Samuel 15:2 through 3. Now go and attack the Amalekites and totally destroy them. Do not spare them. Put to death men and women, children and infants, cattle and sheep, camels and donkeys. That's a bad one. I think Ryan slipped this one in there. I don't know. How about another one? Psalm 137. Babylon, doomed to destruction. Happy is the one who repays you. Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the rocks. You see the problem? You see the problem, right? Those verses, the first two, they work. They're real. It's God speaking to us, but these verses are just as real. They're just as real. But with the approach that we're taking, with the Bible as a phrase book, you're never going to use these. You're never going to read these. You're never going to care about these. These might as well not be in the Bible because they don't work for that process of using it in pieces and parts and applying it to specific situations. It's not that when we learn verses, it's not real. It's that it's not holistic and there's limits to what we can do with that. And so if we just know some phrases and words, but we're not quite speaking the language, then part of our task in this season of learning is to understand what language is God speaking to us. How are we supposed to approach this Bible? How do we approach this holistically so it all means something beautiful so that we can understand what God is trying to communicate to us through this? And so the question that you ask first is, what is this book? What is God doing through through this book. And what we believe here at 514 Church, and I think that what traditional Christian belief in the Bible would say, is that the Bible is the way that God has chosen to reveal himself to people. So the purpose of this book, more so than being an application manual or a life guide, the purpose of this book is to reveal God to us. Our God wants us to know who he is. He wants us to know who we are. What does it mean to be in a relationship with a God like him? What does it mean to live in a world that he's created like this? Who is he? And this book, we believe, is one of the ways that he has revealed himself to us. That's what it's for. That's why we read it. That's why it's here. That's its purpose, first and foremost. And that's beautiful. That is a beautiful reality to live in as a Christian. And so the question becomes, how did he go about revealing himself to us? What's the most effective form of communication he could use? Why did he do it the way that he did? How did he go about it? And I want to teach you a trick. I learned this in middle school when I didn't want to read a novel. You read the first page, and you read the last page, and then maybe you can kind of piece together what's going on in the middle. All right? So you open up the first page of the Bible, and you go to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, dot, dot, dot. And then there's thousands of pages and thousands of years and thousands of stories and characters. And then you get to the last page of the Bible, Revelation chapter 22, and it says, and they will reign forever and ever. In the beginning, and they will reign forever and ever. What kind of literature does that sound like? It's a story. It's a story. Our God has revealed himself to us, first and foremost, in a story. The language of the Bible is story. But we don't usually approach it that way, but it's true. And it makes sense because, let me just use an example from today. I wanted to tell you about my friend Domenico. And I could have just listed attributes for you. I really could have. I could have said he's Italian, he's about 6 feet tall, he has a Chinese wife, but he doesn't speak the language, he lives in China, he's a real estate expert, I think he's funny. But it's not the way that I wanted you to get to know him, right? And so what did I do? I told you stories about him. And now you've never met him, but you get to walk out of the room today and you have this idea of who he is, because stories are effectively the best way that we actually communicate meaning. When we want to reveal something, we tell stories. And so when God wants to reveal himself to us in this book, he gives us a story. In the beginning, and they will reign forever and ever. And I think it's really important that we as a community start to work towards approaching the Bible as if that's true. Approaching it as if it's a story, that all of the pieces and all of the parts are there, but they fit within this larger storyline, this larger narrative that's taking us somewhere. It's taking us somewhere. And so I want to give you a few handles before we bring Joel up here. And I want this to be something that we start to practice. And so let me just really high level go through what the storyline of the Bible is. If you think about like a drama or a play, there's different acts, right? There's like act one, act two, act three, act four, act five. It's a long play, maybe five acts, right? And every time the story is moving somewhere. And the same is true of the Bible. And this is the way that I'll break it down, is that there's five acts. Act one is creation. A good God made a good world. He put his images, us humans, representations of him in charge of that good world. And he told us to take that good world and make it better. Right? Act two, the fall. This is the drama. This is the tragedy. This is the conflict. This is when human beings, instead of taking the good world and by worshiping God, making it better, we decide that instead we're going to worship created things. We're going to give our powers away to things that are not God. And instead of taking a world and making it better, we start to vandalize it and destroy it and bring in chaos and darkness and death. And so Act 3 comes up. Act 3 is the rescue mission, right? Israel, it's a nation. God decides that through one group of people, he's going to save this whole thing. He's going to take us all the way back to Act 1, all the way back to creation, all the way back to the garden, through one family, through this family, this group of people, I am going to save the world. Israel represents humanity, and God's going to work through them. Well, then you keep reading the story. And Israel seems to be afflicted with the same things that humanity is afflicted with, and so it doesn't work. It doesn't work. And so how is he going to save it? If Israel was supposed to stand in for humanity, but they're not doing the right job, then somebody's got to stand in for Israel. Someone has to be the true Israel. Someone has to fulfill what Israel was always supposed to be. And that's why we worship together on Sundays, because we believe that's Jesus. Jesus shows up on the scene and becomes the Israel that they were always supposed to be, and in so doing, becomes the humanity that we were always supposed to be. And he fulfills God's promise to bless the world. And on the cross, all of the world's darkness and all of the world's sin and all of these things that we bring into the world culminated and extinguished themselves on Jesus on the cross, and they killed him and they died with him. And the reason that we're resurrection people is because he rose from the dead. And by raising from the dead, he has defeated both those forces of evil and their consequences, which is death. And now he's the king. Not sometime else, not somewhere else. He is the king right now. That's what Christians profess, which leads us to Act 5. The beautiful thing about Act 5 is that it's in progress. The beautiful thing about this story is that we actually step into the picture in Act 5, and we start to become actors and agents of what God is up to in this world with Jesus as our king. The Apostle Paul says that when we profess faith in Christ, we are in him, which means we're bound to him, which means what happened to him is happening to us. What is true of Jesus is now true of us because we're bound together. And so we walk around as Christians. The word means little Christs, acting as if we're here to bring hope and joy and love and healing and restoration to the world right here, right now, in this moment. We're not waiting for something else. We're not waiting for some time else. That is the story. That's the story of Christianity, and this is the story that we step into. And that is a beautiful story. It's a beautiful story. And when you start to approach this book like that, a couple things happen. Number one, your faith becomes alive, because no longer is your faith about trying to find the right beliefs and the doctrines so that you can say them. All of a sudden, you're not a doctrine declarer, you're a storyteller. You are somebody who actually lives in this story and tries to replay this story by becoming like Jesus. Your faith is alive. It's not just something we believe and profess, it's something that we live and that we are. And that's beautiful. The second thing that happens is the scriptures come alive. The scriptures come alive. Because we don't have to be scared of those verses like 1 Samuel anymore. We don't have to be scared of those verses, because those verses are not exactly the same as every other verse. They fit within the storyline. They fit within the narrative. They fit within one of these places, one of these five acts. And that's important, and I'll show you why here in a second, okay? Now, I don't want to overwhelm everybody. This is a process that will take a long time to understand what the story is and how these stories fit within it. But when we read the Bible, there's a couple questions that we can ask that start to get us there, that start to move us in that direction. And so I'm going to use the 1 Samuel verse as an example, right? God seemingly is commanding the Israelites to go into the land of Canaan and slaughter people in his name so that they can have the land, right? You read that, you're like, that sounds not good. And so you start to ask these questions, right? Here's some questions. Where is this in the story? Because it's not that you just read every verse as if it's the same. They're all part of a narrative now because we're reading it like a story. Where is this in the story? Right? Well, it's after the second act, the fall, and it's before Jesus. So humanity is compromised, and they're not acting the way that they should, and they don't act the way that they should, but God has insisted on continuing to work through them. Okay, that's helpful. It's before Jesus, Act 4, which means that whatever Jesus showed us in terms of clarity of who God is has not been revealed yet. And so there might be some fuzzy. Okay, that doesn't answer any questions, but that helps us understand where this is in the story and why it might seem so strange. The next question actually helps us answer. Because look, the next question you have to ask is, how does the rest of the story inform this part of the story? It's not just where is this in the story, but how does the rest of the story inform this? And when you do this, some really cool things start to happen, and they start to come alive for you. Because think about it. Just keep reading the story. Israel enters the promised land, and they do what it says in 1 Samuel. By violence and conquest, they take it. And then you keep reading. And what happens to Israel? The same thing, right? The same way they entered, now Assyria and Babylon enter and take the land right back. And so they enter by the sword, and they get defeated by the sword. Well, then you keep reading the story, because that didn't work out very well for them. And so you keep reading, and you get to Jesus. And in Matthew 26, it's this scene called Gethsemane, where he gets arrested to go to the cross. And he gets seized by the guards, and Peter chops one of the guards' ears off, and Jesus says, that's not what we're doing here. And Jesus says this, you live by the sword, you die by the sword. So the question is Jesus making up pithy sayings, or is Jesus retelling the story? Is he retelling the story that happened to Israel in a different light? This is now how God's people live. This is now how God's people live. And so all of a sudden, although that verse, you look at it at first and it's troubling, fits within this narrative of who God is trying to tell us that he is and how he's revealing himself to us. And it's beautiful. We don't have to be scared of the Bible. We don't have to be scared of the Old Testament. We just have to understand that it's part of a story and it all fits into ultimately what God is trying to do, which is to reveal himself to us. And so as Joel and I talk about heaven and hell here in a second, this is one of the lenses that we look at everything through. What's the story? Where are we in the story? And I want to go on this journey with this church. This is something that's new to me, and it's really helped. And so I want this church to do this together. And so I'm going to give you guys a resource, all right? There's a resource called The Bible Project. And The Bible Project is just BibleProject.com. They are short animated videos of every single book of the Bible and every single big theme. And just by watching one of these videos, it will put that book into context like you've never put it in context before. It is, in my opinion, the greatest resource available to help us read the scriptures, and it's free. It's free. You can look at it on YouTube. You can go to their website. It is free. I usually don't stand up here and tell people to do something, but I'm going to. If you don't use this when you read the scriptures, you are missing out. This is an amazing tool that will help you put into practice this idea that we're talking about today, where we can start to contextualize different stories and put them into the grand storyline of the Bible. All right? And so what we're going to do today to finish this up is Joel's going to come up, and we are going to sit and look at each other and have a conversation about heaven and hell.